The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The book that we're going to look at is quite short, and so we'll hopefully be able to encompass the whole book, survey the whole book. It's narrative rather than poetry like a psalm or a group of psalms would be, or a gospel, which is a type or genre of literature that is quite unique. It was almost a new invention at the time in the first century. A new type of literature, which is not strictly biography or a narrative of a period. It's different from the narrative that we're going to look at, which does focus on just a few people, so it's not a gospel that we're going to look at. It's not a piece of apocalypse like the apocalypse of John or Ezekiel or Daniel. Just straight narrative. But in the narrative, I think we're going to discover that through the craft of the writer, he has shown us a lot more than just the story. It's a lot like a short story, what we think of as a short story. Not only because it's short, but because of the way it's put together and even the way it introduces the material. That's why I'm holding a book of short stories in my hand, because I'm going to read the first two paragraphs of another short story, a 20th century short story, to show you how much the writer can put in that initial paragraph or two that equips you for the rest of the reading. And you don't even stop to do that, to look at that. When you start a short story, you go through the first two paragraphs very quickly and you keep moving. But if you didn't have those, you would be without a lot of the equipment you need for the journey through the rest of the story. So let me read these, and if you will listen, and you're welcome to take notes, because I want you then to reflect back to me the typical reporter's questions and answers. Who is mentioned in these two paragraphs? Where does it happen? When does it happen? What clues are there about time? It may not be a date so much as other ways of telling you when something happened. Who, where, when, and then we'll also want to see what happens in these two paragraphs, the events that are mentioned. Recently, at the age of 23, Owen Bierdemann had begun to feel the influence of his father, and it wasn't a pleasant one. His father was dead. He'd been dead for 15 years. Throughout adolescence, Owen had felt the need of anyone who loses a parent at an early age to fill in the outline of his father, to invent traits and features and predilections for him. And since it was difficult for Owen to remember his father, and his mother could not or would not answer Owen's questions about him, Owen had fabricated and found he now faced a vast and spurious personality. His mother was a presence Owen could rebel against or conciliate, hate or love. But every time he thought of his father, he felt he was beating against blackness. And when Owen moved to New York a year ago, freeing himself from his mother's territory, a change began. Working at the Overseas Press Club, where he edited teletype dispatches, or pacing his studio apartment, Owen began to sense that his attitudes and gestures and even a certain tone of voice had the feeling of being familiar. They were his father's. So Owen realized he had to separate what he had invented from the truth. Well, first, when do these things happen? What did the author tell you about when? What clues did you discover?
He was 8 years old when his father died.
And how did you figure that out? Did he tell us that?
23, and his father died 15 years ago.
Uh-huh. So you had those two time things, and then you worked out the math for the third. So there's a period of time that's elapsed. Any other time indicators that you noticed?
Well, he left his home a year ago and moved to New York.
Uh-huh. So that the point that we're at now has these other times behind. A year ago, 15 years ago, 23 years ago, and it helps us to understand when the father died. How old was Owen? Where? What places?
Well, right now he's in a studio in Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other wheres?
I think the wheres help us with the when as well, because this is not something, it's not a short story about something that happened, but there's sort of a modern mindset that there's...
Yeah. All right. So we know it's contemporary from some of those. Any other things that were mentioned that give you a sense of whether it's this year or a few years ago? Well, think about some of the events. What is he doing now?
Realization about what his father was like. And it sounds like it's still in progress, this mm-hmm. kind of realization he's going through.
Yeah. Other events or things that he's doing or has done.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That was
Yes.
Probably.
That's very much a where thing, right? Do you remember how it was described, the moving away from his mother? The exact words he used? His mother's territory. Yeah. Larry Wirewood has chosen each of these words very carefully. It's very succinct.
In other words.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Yes. Think about his job. What does he do at the Overseas Press Club? Anyone remember that? He edited teletype dispatches. Did that give you any clue about a when? And why the 50s?
Well, teletype kind of,
yeah.
It's not modern. It's not computerized stuff.
No, right. This is before computer.
After the 30s and so forth.
Yeah. Does everyone know what teletype is? Yeah. You're a computer person.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That was how the news was spread electronically, before the computer age, just before the computer age. You still hear the term wire service. Wire services now work over the internet. Electronically and without wires, actually. But the news was carried by wire, and you put it on the wire. You would type it up, and it would be sent out literally over a wire, telephone type of hookup, to a machine that would print it out. But this was all before computers. So that does date it. Some of the other things that happened... What does he tell you? Some of these I think we've alluded to, but let's kind of collect them again and look at them. What happened in these two paragraphs? What happened when he was 8 years old? His father died. See, that's what I mean by going back and collecting these things now. His father died. He moved away from home to New York. He works at a job at a certain place at the Overseas Press Club. Yeah, and the task, you were talking about that. That comes at the very end. After all the other facts of the who, what, when, where, now he has realized he has to separate what he had invented from the truth. And this is the task of the story. If you read the rest of the story, which you ought to do someday, this is from a book called Silent Passengers by Larry Wywoody. He was here last year for the conference, and you would remember him, perhaps. novelist and was one of the keynote presenters last year, a Christian writer of fiction. Now let me read you another introduction to a short book story. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and two sons. Listen for the who, what, when, where. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. When they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. When does this happen?
When the judges rule.
Any other time indicators?
Famine.
So that would, among all the years when the judges rule, that would help to narrow it down some more if you knew when the famines occurred. Anything else about time that was mentioned?
Reference in there to 10 years.
Yeah. What is the 10 years associated with? Yeah. And what happened at the 10-year point? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the events are on a time scale. Where? Mm-hmm. So two locations are mentioned. Now, it will help us to, in a little bit, we'll begin to look at where these really are so we get a sense of it. But just like in the Wywoody story, there's one place and then another. And we, because it's New York, we all know where that is. And he doesn't tell us exactly where the other place is, but the transition is there. Who are the people? Who are the characters that are mentioned? Yeah, Mahlon and Chilion. And what are the two daughters-in-law's names?
Ruth and Orpah.
Ruth and Orpah. Six people, and they all have names. In the Wywoody story, how many names were there? Just Owen's name. Yeah. That gives a certain quality to this beginning of the story. They all have names. And I think it's significant, and something that we sometimes are not sensitive to when we read the Bible, is to who is named in a narrative. And I think it's interesting in a society that we think of as patriarchal, that the women's names are here very clearly at this beginning, because we don't know where the story is going to go beyond this.
Yeah,
the three women are the survivors. So we would suspect that the story would be about them. Although, and of course, what I'm trying to get you to do is to forget what you already know about Ruth at this point, to approach it fresh so that you appreciate what's in these first five sentences. Actually, it's fewer than five, probably five sentences when it's punctuated. But anyway, it's very brief, and yet a lot is here. Now, I've saved the what until we get to the end of the string here, because I want to start putting stuff on the chalkboard now. And I use a horizontal outline format because it's partly a picture. It's not just words and the way, like an ABC 1-2-3 outline. When I get done with this, I look at it and I've got a map that tells me with the words, but it also tells me spatially what's going on. Now, this book has four chapters, and I have copies of it here if you want to spread those around. So we'll all be working with the same translation. And this is not always the case with a biblical book, that you can simply use the chapter divisions to divide the book for outline purposes. But in this case, you can. And I'm just going to say that dogmatically. We'll see that it does work out that way. So in this first chapter, there's this little section. It's the first five verses. And we've been looking at when this happened, where it happened, and who it happened to. But now the events themselves, I want us to look at them rather carefully and in the order in which they occur, because the way the author has chosen to tell us of these events is arranged so that that telling has a stronger effect. The author could choose to use straight chronology, could choose to ignore chronology and tell us the events in some other way, other sequence, for his own purpose. So we won't assume that it's chronological. But what's the first thing that he says happens, the first event in verse 1? Well, that's the time, but what happens during that period? What's the first thing that happens? A famine happened. So first is a famine. Now, where does this famine happen? Bethlehem. What does Bethlehem mean? See, that escapes us. It's an English word that just escapes us. It means house of bread. Beit Lachem. And you've seen synagogues with Beit Shalom and so on. That's the house of peace and so on. Well, this is the house of bread. A famine in the house of bread. So even that little texture, when you know what the name means, says something. And so certainly someone reading in Hebrew would catch it right away, or hearing it told in Hebrew. Now what happens after the famine? Yeah, and where do they go?
To the country of Moab.
Okay. Now, is there a significance in that? Is this like going from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh? Or is it a different kind of transition in terms of quality, not distance? I'm not thinking of distances right at the moment. What does Moab mean?
The pagan land?
So it's a different culture, spiritually different culture. Any other things about Moab that you remember that would be significant for someone going from Bethlehem? Is it a friendly country? Yeah, all right. Now, why?
I guess because they were pagan.
All right, I want to show you something on the map that takes it just a little further, and I think this will explain it. In the days when the judges ruled, and that's where we're going to use this map now. This is a map that tells you what was going on through the space. In the days of the judges, there were repeated invasions from other places. They had children of Israel had come up the east side of the Dead Sea through Edom and Moab and Ammon. See Ammon here, and had crossed the Jordan and had conquered most of the land. That's the story of the book of Joshua. The story of the book of Judges is that repeatedly Israel became unfaithful in one way or another, and another nation came in and dominated them for a period, and then a judge came and liberated them. And during the rest of that judge's life, things were orderly and more or less righteous. And then after his death, it didn't continue, and things fell apart. And they were. So the first one was from Mesopotamia. The second one was Moab coming in and dominating as a foreign enemy for 18 years until they were defeated. Then the Philistines, an old enemy, the third one. And then a king from the city of Hazor came down. And this is when Deborah and Barak defeated them. The fifth one is the story of Gideon. And that's the Midianites from here and the Amalekites from here. These two fives coming in. So two nations had to be defeated. And then the Ammonites, Jephthah defeated them. And then Samson, the final story, the Philistines again. So that tells you something about the chaos of the period, but it particularly underlines the significance of going from Bethlehem to Moab. Now, how would they get there? Look at the map and tell me, how would you go if you were in Bethlehem, just south of Jerusalem, and you wanted to go to Moab over on the east side here? And you'd have to go... Yeah, but you can't go straight, can you? You have to go around one way or the other. And you have to go through Ammon. And it doesn't show on this map, but Edom is down here. So you have to go through another territory to get to Moab, which had been an enemy. And we don't know exactly when in the period of the Judges the story of Ruth happens, before or after this particular. But so it's enemy territory. It's difficult. This is highlands, mountains, sort of like the Poconos, or the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, 2,000 to 3,000 feet high. This is a deep valley, the River Jordan. This is the lowest surface on the earth, 1,200 feet down. So we've got a 4,500 foot difference between the mountains here and here. And then you climb back up to the high plateau here. So a difficult journey, probably on foot, carrying a few possessions, maybe having a donkey. Possibly even a camel, but actually there's nothing about that in the story as to what they had to carry their possessions. So going to Moab is like going to live among the enemy. I'm going to say it's like an exile. It's bad enough to have to leave home because of famine, but then to find the place where you can survive in terms of food, to be in the midst of enemies, threatening people, foreign culture, pagan culture. It's an exile of some kind. What's the next thing that happens? Yes. And after that? And? Yes. So there's deaths. And what does it say about Naomi at the end of the first paragraph? In at the end of verse 5. Yeah, she's alone. Now, I'm having us pay attention to what is said in the description of her, not what we might stop and think, oh, but there are these two daughters-in-law. But that's not, the text says she's left without, that she's alone. What happens in terms of the daughters-in-law will come up. But the author focuses on the aloneness. This was bad enough, the famine. This is even worse. This is even worse. This is the worst of all. The author has moved us to a kind of climax. Now, it's not a climax at the top. It's at the bottom. We've come to the bottom of the story. But... The literary device that the author is using here is that of moving toward a climax, where things get worse and worse and worse until you get to... That's all in five verses. One of the things about narrative, either fiction or nonfiction, but where it's a narrative, is that one of the features is that a complication develops that has to be resolved. This is the place where the complication suddenly surprises us. This is bad enough, but the family is coping. But this really complicates things for Naomi. And it's unforeseen. The exile follows from the famine, but the deaths don't follow from the exile. That is a surprising turn, and it's a complication. That somehow, that's what's going to have to be solved. And this is just describes the result of those tests. Now, when we move into verse 6, we're going to look through the rest of chapter 1, and we're going to move a little more quickly now, but we want to notice what happens. What's the first thing that Naomi hears? What does she hear in verse 6? Yeah, she hears about food. Bethlehem is now going to be, again, the house of bread. Notice that's a contrast to the famine. Because of the food, then what does she begin to do? Yeah, she begins to return. Another contrast. This is good, this is better. Then we have to read through, remember through this whole interchange with the daughters-in-law, where she sends them back to their mothers, kisses them goodbye, and Orpah goes, and Ruth will not go. And she tries to send Ruth a second time, and Ruth will not go. But Ruth's answer, which these are a set of words that we remember very strongly. Do not press me to leave you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. And then she concludes this with an oath. May the Lord do thus and so to me and more as well, if even death aparts me from you. Whom does she have now in place of her lost husband and sons? Yeah, she has Ruth in place of these deaths. When she gets back, when they too get back to Bethlehem, verse 19, they come to Bethlehem, and the whole town is stirred because of them. And the women say, is this Naomi? And then there's another section that's recited like poetry, her speech. Call me no longer Naomi, call me Mara. And we have footnotes because those are transliterations of Hebrew words, names, but they have meaning. They're common ordinary names in Hebrew. Naomi means pleasant and Mara means bitter. So speaking to them in Hebrew, she's saying, don't call me pleasant. You've been calling me that all these years. That's been my name. Call me bitter. Why? Well, I went away full. The Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has dealt harshly with me. The Almighty has brought calamity on me. Whose name in that couplet there, 20 and 21, appears four times in two forms? Who is mentioned four times? The Lord. I think that's a contrast to the aloneness. And she is doing what Dr. Logan was talking about last night. She's looking at events, and she has the hermeneutical key. She knows what the meaning of those events is. Even in her pain of bitterness, the Lord is directing her life. She says that painfully, but the Lord is directing her life. So she is not alone. This is good. This gets better. This is even better. Better than returning is to return with Ruth and to return with the consciousness that the Lord is directing her paths. Another climactic sequence, answering the first one. And you have contrasts as you bring the four pairs together. So the author has woven this tale carefully. It's not been just sort of casually reminisced. It's been put together very carefully, and as we look at it, we're beginning to understand why it feels so powerful when we read through it. Now, we started with famine. When we get to the last verse, the last phrase of 22, when is this that they come to Bethlehem? Yes. So we go from famine through food, but famine to the harvest as we traverse this first chapter. Now, that's quite a story all by itself. But, of course, there's more. Naomi is empty, but I would say with hope. There are these hints of hope, these good things that have developed, and it's the time of the harvest. So there's certainly hope, even with all of her feeling of emptiness. Now, when we move into the second chapter, what does the author tell us, the reader, so that we'll understand what's going on as we read the second chapter? What does the author tell us right at the beginning of the chapter? Yes, Naomi had a kinsman. Now, I have these books here, but I think we better not take the time for you to dig around in them, but you may want to afterward. But to understand the role of the kinsman in that society, you said, you translated it relative, yeah. What does this relative mean in that culture? Does anyone remember that from other Bible study?
Far more than we had. Yeah. More responsibility probably for the family.
Yeah, okay. It's a role of responsibility for the family. Any other clues that you remember?
They have...
To marry the widow.
Yeah, right.
Often a brother of the deceased, but the closest relative in any case. It also had to do with redeeming the property that was supposed to be coming to this widow and her children. That was the husband's property, which may have been alienated one way or another, sold because of poverty or lost. And not in Naomi's case, they were away and it probably wasn't cultivated and farmed. And so it was land, but not productive at this point. So this is a role of responsibility. It's not just what, as you said, well, we've got a cousin with that lives near us. But one who has responsibility, not just good intentions. We know that because this is told to us. Notice in the conversation with Ruth and Naomi, nothing is said about where she will go exactly. Just she will go to a field. Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose sight I may find favor. Now, there's a little background to think about here. What does she mean by gleaning? And that's something else that if we had a little more time, you could dig in here and read about in one of these reference books. Grain. Yeah, not the chaff, that's straw that's left behind, but grain. They were instructed, the owners of the field were instructed not to make a second pass through the field to clean up, but to let the widows and other poor come and do the cleaning up of the pieces that got missed. They were also not to cut in the harvest all the way into the corner of the field, to leave that for the gleaners to cut for themselves. So they were just not to be as efficient as they might be in harvesting for the sake of widows and other poor, but in this case, widows. So Ruth knows about this. It may have been a Moabite custom. It may have been a wider custom than just in Israel, in the Middle East at that time. But in Israel, it was part of the law to maintain this custom. So she says, let me go to the field and glean, behind someone in whose sight I may find favor. Let me go find a place that will let me do this, so we can have something to eat. And she says, go. She goes and she finds a field and she's gleaning. And this person, Boaz, comes. It's his field. Now, for us, right away, this moves the story up a notch. Ruth is just looking for someone that'll treat her nicely. She doesn't know what we know about Boaz. And they greet each, Boaz and the workers greet each other. He asks who she is. He gets the story about her. And so then Boaz goes and talks to her. And he says, stay in this field. Don't go somewhere else. And keep close to the women in my harvesting team and follow behind them. And also, I've ordered the young men not to bother you. There's always the threat in that culture, and in ours too, of harm that will come to women who are not protected, physical and sexual violence. So he's very specific in both welcoming her and providing her with protection. And she wants to know why. And he says, well, I've heard what you've done to help your mother-in-law. So this is worthy. May the Lord reward you. And she says, may I continue to find favor in your sight. You have comforted me. You have spoken kindly to me. And then at mealtime, there's more. So we're going to be looking at gifts that are given to Ruth as we move through these last three chapters. And the first specific gift is in verse 14. What does he give her there? Mm-hmm. And?
Wine.
This is the food that was prepared for the harvesters, and he welcomes her to their table. So, gifts of food, wine, and I'm looking for where it is. There's water also, the water jug. Did anyone find that? Seems to me that was there too. Yeah. All right, but there's food and wine, the lunch. She's welcome to the lunch. Then what does he tell the young men in 15 and 16? Yeah. And in 16. So she's getting not just what would have fallen, but extra. So gifts of food and wine, gleaning, and extra. Yeah, I think that's really a third stage. I'm going to just put the word bundles there. Now, in the gleaning, she gleans in the field until evening. She beats out what is gleaned. It's about an ephah of barley, 17. That's 3/5 of a bushel of grain. There's the lunch up here. That's enough for a day. This is enough for, let's say, a month, several days of food, because 3/5 of a bushel is certainly going to be more than one day's grain. And then he said that she should stay throughout the harvest. And I'm looking for that. I just remember that that's there. Well, anyway, she does go throughout the...
Verse 21.
Yeah, he even said to me, stay until we finish the whole harvest. So that's food for the winter or for the year. So good, better, and best again, this climax thing. And gifts of food and wine, gifts of gleaning, and even more abundance than she normally would find in this. So it's not only a time, but all this extra out of the bundles, so that things just keep building. And in the midst of that, this building toward climax, there is this discovery of where she is. This is so interesting. She tells her mother-in-law where she had worked in verse 19. Naomi says, where were you today? Blessed is the man who took notice of you. The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. Naomi already knows what Boaz means. It doesn't mean the same thing to Ruth. Naomi's reaction is so electric here. Blessed be he by the Lord whose kindness is not forsaken. This man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin. He's far more than just a generous farmer. That's all Ruth thinks of him as at this point. He's the kinsman. So that as wonderful as all this is, there's promise of more. Boaz is introduced. But the way he's introduced has so much craft to it. He's not just introduced at the beginning to us and let lay there, but the author tells this story with all that tension built in. As when is Ruth going to realize who this person is? And it's not until Naomi puts the pieces together for her hits. Now, what does Boaz do in chapter 3? What happens in chapter 3? This is quite a story in itself, this chapter. Naomi begins by saying, I need to seek some security for you. In other words, we need to work with this possibility. You found a kinsman who's been kind to you. Now let's see what else we can work out of this. So there's this whole episode at the threshing floor. And out of that, what does Boaz do? What's the result of that whole episode there? Look particularly at verses 11, 12, 13. Right in there is the crux of Boaz's action. Now, this is a small complication right there. We've invested quite a bit in Boaz already. And we're thinking he's, even if we don't know the end of the story, but of course we all do, but we're thinking, now this guy could marry her and that would solve Ruth's problem. It would take care of Naomi for the rest of her days. It would take care of the property, the family property, all this sort of thing. The complication is that there's another guy. Another kinsman. So we have to resolve that. This is almost as good as a fiction short story where the complications show up right on schedule and keep tightening the pace of the narrative. So the story is not going to be over yet. So, but he makes a promise. Now, how does he seal the promise when the night is over in verse 15? What does he give her there? Six measures. That's maybe more than the ephah. You'd have to look that up. Maybe a commentary or something would help. But there's a gift of seed or grain. And there's no gleaning to get it, no threshing to get it. That's all been done, the harvesting. He just gives her the grain. So it's a more gracious gift than even this, which was great. But she had to do the work. That was the way the system worked, that the widow, the poor, worked with the harvesters and gained the gift in that way. Here, he gives it outright. And Boaz promises. What's going to happen? In as the story unfolds, we have to turn the page. The storyteller is doing very well. And Naomi replies in verse 18 of chapter 3, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Boaz goes to the gate and sits down next to the next of kin. Now, again, there's some cultural background, but even without it, we probably appreciate the story pretty fully. But the gate is the place where these kinds of legal transactions are worked out. We might say go to the Registrar of Deeds or the Common Pleas Court or something where the legally binding decisions can be made about this. But the gateway is where they do that. And he sits down to the next of kin. And it's so much fun to watch him go over this. And he gets the 10 elders around, a kind of court, an ad hoc court, He lays out the story. Naomi has come back from Moab and is selling a parcel of land that belonged to our kinsman Elimelech. They often did that. Not a permanent sale the way we might, but a kind of sale that's really a lease until the year of Jubilee when all the land goes back to the families originally. So you would lease it for whatever number of years were left until the Jubilee. This is the way the system has worked. But he calls it selling here. And the next of kin is the person who's supposed to step up and take care of this. So it's still in the larger family. Buy it in the presence of those sitting here. If you will redeem it, redeem it. If you will not, tell me so that I may know. And then I come after you and I will redeem it. So the man says, well, okay, I'll redeem it. Then he says, someone comes with the land. Ruth, a Moabite widow, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance. In other words, the children born would be really her husband's, first husband's children's in the inheritance line, rather than the new husband's children for purposes of inheritance. So that the land then would only be owned for a short time, and then the sons would get it back at the Jubilee. And he says, well, I can't do this. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot. And then they trade sandals, which is the way of sealing the transaction. And Boaz says to the elders, you are witnesses today. I'm down in verse 9. I've acquired from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and Chilion and Mahlon and Ruth the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon, to be my wife, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance, and so on. It's just going through the usual legal formula for that. And you are my witnesses. And they say, yes, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah. Why did he pick those two names? Yeah. Yeah, going back to the patriarchs, but particularly to the many children that came out. Six children just from those two, and then the other six sons came from their handmaids. In this polygamous house of Jacob. So produce children in Ephrathah and bestow a name in Bethlehem, and so on. So verse 13 is so interesting. What does Boaz do there in verse 13? What does he give in verse 13 to Ruth? Yeah. What does he give her? In order for her to have a son, what does he give her?
Marriage.
Marriage. He gives her himself and his seed for the child. Notice the progression here. There's food here, and then grain, seed, through the gleaning process in greater abundance than she should normally expect. Then he gives her the seeds, grain, in as part of his promise. And then as Boaz acts, the act is finally to give himself to her in marriage and give her his seed and then a son. Now there's another conversation with Naomi and the women. Think of the one when she first came back to Bethlehem in the first chapter. Remember that, and now look at this one. The women say to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left, this is to Naomi now, not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. Who do you think of first as the next of kin for Naomi? Who are they thinking of?
Boaz.
Yeah, we think of Boaz. That's what, but that we keep listening to them, and they say, he will be to you a restorer of life, nourisher in your old age. Still sounds like Boaz. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him. Now who are we talking about? Yeah, Obed. So he's called the next of kin here for Naomi. But who is better than seven sons? Ruth. That's another next of kin for Naomi. Another redeemer. Obed, Ruth, and of course, Boaz. There's really three redeemer figures, next of kin figures, to meet the needs of Naomi, the one who was left alone at the beginning of the book. They even say in verse 17, a son has been born to Naomi. This is part of that raising up for the dead man his own children, that through the union of Boaz and Ruth, we're really giving a son to Naomi. Not just a grandson, which is fine, but in this rich sense, a son, a next of kin who will take care of her in her old age. As much as Boaz and Ruth would do for her, Obed is particularly singled out. Well, that's a wonderful story. What does it mean? Is there more than we've already found in the meaning of this? We have yet to look at another short paragraph that looks like a very simple list of names. But first, who is Obed's son and grandson? David. Ah, now this is getting even more interesting. This is not just an isolated family. In contrast to the chaos and corruption of the period of the judges, but this is a family that feeds into the royal household. But then in verse 18 through 22, there's a list of names, a genealogy, and it goes forward to David, as we noticed. Where does it go back to? And where have we run into Perez before in the book, in this story? Right back in verse 12, where the elders are talking to Boaz at the gate. Who's his father? Perez. And who's Judah? I mean, why is that significant? Yep, son of Jacob. Grandson of, great-grandson of Abraham. So this little baby, about that size, is a bridge between the patriarchs and the kings. And this is part of the Messiah's line, it turns out. So that at this point, where it might have been extinguished, if Boaz had not had a son named Obed, who then had a son and a grandson, humanly speaking, the line could have been extinguished right at this point by this famine and these deaths and this emptiness. But this, God preserves it, so it's a story of preservation. But this whole figure, the way it's accomplished through the kinsman redeemer, of course, is also a picture of the Messiah's work, not just his family line being preserved, but that he will come the same way. That Obed is a picture, then, of Christ, who will be a baby, born in spite of. Who would have thought that Ruth would have a baby in these circumstances? Or that Naomi would have a son again? This is all just in spite of. And who would have thought that Mary would bear the Messiah when we meet her in the Gospels? So that this is one of those unusual births, like Samuel to Hannah and Isaac to Abraham and Sarah. This is another one in the line that points finally to the most unusual birth of all, who will be the kinsman or redeemer. This was in the period of the judges, and when you begin to think about that, those judges, as they came along, there were 12 of them. We remember maybe a half a dozen of them, like Gideon and Samson and Deborah and Jephthah. We don't remember all their names, usually. They came to redeem Israel out of bondage over and over again, this recurring bondage that we saw on the map. They didn't come within this custom of the kinsmen. They came in that larger political, military redeemer, but they came to redeem from bondage nonetheless over and over again. This redeemer that will come will not be a part of of repeated cycles, but he will do the job effectively. And I think that's part of the larger context that we're working with here. So what we're doing what we've done in Bible study here is to notice how the book was put together. And we've tried to do it inductively. In other words, we've tried to just look and see what's there and make lists and ask questions. And finally, patterns begin to emerge. We begin to notice that this theme of famine, food, grain, seed here, it ties the book together. It's a sub-theme that's working all the time. If we're watching the people mostly, and we may be fascinated by the people, this is going on beside this, and it helps to sustain and give unity. It's like when you look at a painting, and you may be fascinated by the people that are in the painting, the figures, or the action that's being portrayed. A really good painting has unity that's put together by a lot of subtle undercurrents of the use of a certain color in the right places throughout the painting to tie it together. Or the use of the same brush stroke in different places with different colors of paint and in different kinds of areas, on a rock, on the roundness of a person's head, on an umbrella. And they're different objects. So when you look at them, you say, well, that's a rock, and this is a person's head, this is an umbrella, but it's the same curve that's being used over and over again. And that's what I think is happening here, that while we're watching the people, this subtext of grain is and seed is going through. And then it suddenly gets transformed here into the seed that produces a baby. So that this book, which when we just pick it up and read it, is so satisfying to read, has been put together so well that we just don't notice it. The German poet and writer Goethe said it was the best short story from a point of view of art that he'd ever seen. And all of that is to carry this message of redemption in the midst of chaos. This is in the period when the judges rule. Not the kind of culture you would choose to live in, but not all that different from the one you do live in. At the end of the book of Judges, after the cycles are over, at the end of verse chapter 16, and you've gone through this judge bondage cycle 12 times, the last five chapters give you two stories that are more like the story of Ruth in structure. They don't have that cyclical nature to them at all. One is the story of a priest who was unworthy in the way he behaved of being a priest, an improper priest, very improper. The worship that he was associated with was corrupt. And then there's the story of a Levite. And if you remember much about the story, at one point he pushes his concubine outside the door to be abused by the men of the city, and then he chops her up in pieces and sends her all over the place. This horrible story of violence against a woman. Those stories are just told as characteristic of the period. And then the last verse of the book, everyone did what was right in his own eyes, sums up the whole period. Those last two stories center around Bethlehem. And Ruth centers around Bethlehem as a deliberate contrast. In our English Bibles, the arrangement is one right next to the other. Judges, and the next book is Ruth. In the Hebrew canon, Ruth is somewhere else in the third section. You have the Torah, you have a set of prophetic writings, and then you have the beginning of the book of Psalms, a group of more miscellaneous books that they call the writings. And Ruth is one of the short scrolls there. But the writer, probably after or during the time of David or shortly after, in other words, quite a while after the story actually happened, writing it, is deliberately contrasting the moral situation in Ruth with the moral situation during the period of Judges. That God reaches in the midst of that kind of mess to act redemptively for a family and through that family for many others. I think it's deeper than just kind providence toward a family that could be knocked around and be abused, that it's more deeply theological than that, that this is part of the story of redemption acted out on this scale in this very real concrete situation for us to look at and to be encouraged by. Other observations or questions? We have a few minutes before we're supposed to move on. Well, the first hour, I had people use them, and we didn't get to all this heavy stuff at the end, so I didn't do that this time. To appreciate the journey that they had to take, I had somebody look in the atlas and figure out a few things, but we can look at this map now. This is, as the crow flies, maybe 40 or 50 miles, but to get there walking either way, it's more like 70. Be overnight on the road walking, or even if you had a camel, you'd still walk at a human walking pace. It wouldn't be rapid by any means. If 20 miles, if you made 20 miles a day, you'd be doing very well. You might not make that much. So that means camping out along the way. Think of two women moving through alien cultures. They managed to function in Moab, but they got to go through either Ammon or Edom to get home. That's one dimension, and this atlas would help with that. Just plotting where these are and what you have to go through to get there. This commentary fills in some of the things we noticed about Moab that we figured out from the map, partly, the enemy relationship. And the background on Kinsmen, which you already knew, so enough of you knew of some of it that we could get into it, but it's very fascinating to read what they say about it. And then figuring out the genealogy, the commentary on the genealogy. This is a one-volume commentary, so it's fairly brief and succinct, but the material that's there that opens up some of these things is very valuable. This is a new Dictionary of Biblical Imagery, that was edited by Tremper Longman, who is an adjunct here now but was here full-time, and Lee Ryken, who taught literature at Wheaton College for years. But just working with the images that are present in the words, and that looking up things like kinsmen and finding both the literal meaning of it that we talked about, which you put your finger on, a near relative with responsibility, but then all the theological meaning, which we worked out in terms of Christ being the ultimate kinsman, and gleaning just what the custom for gleaning was, and you knew enough about that to get us started. And then it's interesting that even in a book that you think would be just figures of speech, symbols, images, motifs, metaphors, there's even an article about Ruth and what she stands for and how she becomes more than just a character in a story, a kind of metaphor. These two are for sale out on the book table, and you should look through them. This, you're more familiar with the type of book it is. I think it's the best one-volume commentary because it's thorough enough, but it's quick and succinct also. It's not as highly technical as many commentaries. It covers the whole Bible in one volume. This is fascinating because this is not as technical as you would think. It's very accessible to all kinds of readers. And I just love to look at maps, so atlases are lots of fun. So that's the story on the books, yes?
This does not exactly say that in there at all.
Yeah.
I don't know where they get that from.
And I've never sorted that out thoroughly. And whether we, in one sense, we may not need the physical line.
Right. In a sense, almost like with Ruth and with
the legal line may be enough to satisfy. And at the beginning of trying to sort that out, a good assumption to make in any of those conundrums is, let's suspend what I expect is necessary and see how the Bible really handles this. And it may handle it quite differently than I would expect it to. And then let that be the standard for how I will think about it. And this is a good example there that we tend to think in terms of physical genealogy and think, well, that's the norm. And so then the Bible's going to follow that norm. Well, maybe it doesn't. Maybe that's fine in our cultural setting, but there may be another way of working this out so that you have a true genealogy. But let's see how the Bible does it, if we can sort it out, rather than taking our cultural assumptions in to drive the process of doing the thinking and the research. Our assumptions get in the way